how can we, it is very basic, isn't it? How do we know anything? And it seemed a good place to start, really. Obviously, that lies behind the question. We can't know about God unless we can work out what it means to know. And this took me to the extraordinary question of Pilate to Christ at his trial. What is truth? And Jesus had, of course, provoked this question. Jesus had said, "For this reason I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Now, this is an absolutely amazing statement. I mean, for this reason he came into the world. What was the reason you came into the world? Why did you turn up?
My parents.
Yes, you didn't have any say in it at all, did you? So it's an extraordinary thing to say that this is why I came. Because no one else can talk like that. And then to say that everyone on the side of truth listens to me. It's an extraordinary statement. It's worthy, at first glance, don't misread me, at first glance is worthy of some of the things that Donald Trump says, rattles off his wholesale wonderful statements that leave you gasping. In the Monty Python film Life of Brian, we have this Christ figure who's not Christ. He's Brian, and but they're calling him the Messiah, and they're fussing around him. And they go to his mother and says, "Is he the Messiah?" He says, "He's not a Messiah. He is a very naughty boy. And that surely has to be the upshot here, that to talk in these terms, Jesus is either the arch-deceiver who's pulled off the greatest confidence trick in history, or he is the Messiah. And this question clearly precipitates the issues. So Pilate says, "What is truth?" and then walked away. In more recent years, there's another fellow who had big troubles with truth, and that, at least, the people listening to him had troubles with truth. That's Donald Rumsfeld in a famous interview where he said, "There are known knowns." There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That's to say, there are things we know that we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. They're the ones that we don't know we don't know. And it seems that this was very fundamental in what the Oxford English Dictionary have said as their word of the year last year, post-truth. Because it was the decision to go to war in Iraq where the politicians told us there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, which is what Rumsfeld was going on about. And they said, "We know that he has these weapons." And he didn't have these weapons. So here was a political post-truth of which the whole world is reeling all these years later. So the question really this afternoon is, how do we know what it means to know? And we need to spend some time thinking about it. Was Rumsfeld right when he said there are known knowns? Are there any known knowns? And the answer seems to be that there are, but in very limited fields. There are in mathematics 2 + 2 = 4. Whatever words you put it into, the concept is clearly, inevitably true. And it's also true in logic. If you take a strictly logical deduction, we can be confident of where it leads. So if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. So even if you only say that A equals B and B equals C. You have said implicitly in that sentence that A is the same as C. But outside that sort of strict logic or mathematics, what do we really know? Well, let's start thinking about our consciousness. I'm sure you all dream occasionally. Some of you are probably dreaming now. Carry on. I had a vivid dream last night, actually. I was quite caught up in all sorts of characters appeared in this dream who I have never known before or since. But it was very real, and I took a little time to come round. I also get a recurring nightmare. This is not only real, but very painful. And I wake up in a muck sweat and very distressed. I dreamt vividly that I failed my finals. And I have to then, hold on. I not only didn't fail my finals, I've had 30 years as a GP, and I've been retired for 10 years. I don't have to worry about exams ever again. It's wonderful. And gradually I sort of settled down. But the stress of going through final exams was having effects on me 40 or more years later. A Chinese philosopher said, if when I'm asleep I dream I'm a butterfly, how do I know that when I'm awake I'm not a butterfly dreaming I'm a man? And I don't think we can answer that question for him. There is something very dreamlike about the experience of life, isn't there? And this transition between what is the sort of hallucination of a dream and what actually the hard outside world at times can be quite confusing. And then we start to think about, well, there are all sorts of things we know about the past, but do we know about the past? If you were to write down about yesterday, what you did, you might remember where you had lunch. And I can remember in the evening, I went out with my wife to Chichester Theatre and we saw Iolanthe, so I can remember that. In a short while, I'll have forgotten where we had supper. If I was to try and clarify these things, I'd need to pull in witnesses. So I might call in other people that I met during the day. Where was I? Where was it? So you can establish. But how do I know he's got it right? You see? Was that the day before we met? And we soon very quickly struggle to construct even the recent past. In medicine, we have got this, I think, alarming phenomenon of false memory syndrome, where people are absolutely convinced that usually somebody sexually abused them or did some terrible thing in the past. There was a woman that I was reading about just recently who said that she had not even recalled this event until after 35 years. So she was saying that she has been aware of it for the last 5 years, that she was abused 35 years previously, but was not consciously aware of it until the last 5 years. Now, is that false memory syndrome? And how are we to know? How is anyone to know? So the past is difficult, knowing about the past. Knowing about the present is quite difficult too. Alistair McGrath's written a charming book called Inventing the Universe, and in it he talks about the problem of the now, what it means to be now. And he comments on Einstein's view of time and space. And he says it's a wonderfully impersonal, abstract account, which left McGrath wondering, where do I fit in with this? What this phenomenon of being me in the abstract sense of time and space, where's all that? And this is, of course, at the root of the existential dilemma. What is our now that we experience? We think we experience a now. We may recall previous nows, the ones that stick in our mind. We can't predict the next now. We could be in for a big surprise in the next 5 minutes. Don't bank on it, probably won't be. But this now is a very brief transient experience. And it seems to me that McGrath makes more of it. The situation is even worse than McGrath thinks, because by the time we register the now, it's already in the past. So if I see something outside the window, well, I don't see anything out of the window tonight, but if I see something there, what's that? Is that a bird? Of course, by the time I've registered, yes, that was a bird. The bird has flown. So our experience of the now is already, there's a time lag in it. Of course, we can study the past. That's what history is all about. And we can dig into it and we can find documents. It's quite a complex and arduous task to verify. I don't know whether any of you have pursued your family histories, have you? I mean, the very basic bits of information. Okay, granddad died then. And then you've got to try and work out where was he when he died. And was he alone? Was anyone with him? Are we ever going to know? Just fragments that we can construct from the past. So history itself is fraught with difficulty. I went to a cinema this week and they showed a trailer for the David Irving film that's coming up about his denial of the Holocaust. One of the most major events in the last 100 years. And, you know, he denies it ever happened. You know, how does that happen? So the past is quite difficult to tie down. Is science any better than history in this regard? Well, all that we do in science is in the past. So we might have done a terrific experiment yesterday. It really went well, great results. But it's all in the past. If I'd done this experiment with Professor Fox, great privilege that would be. You know, has he written it down? Did he get the results down? Has he recorded them? And because he wants this paper published, has he recorded them accurately? Or has he... Well, we'll just round these figures up, because if we can get this published in such and such journal, I could get promotion, get a new job, or sell a book, or whatever. And there's great concern in science today about fraud in science, where people have twisted the truths. And this is very easily done. I was involved in writing a paper years ago about a behaviour of children in a school. And it didn't show, to my mind, the clear results that I hoped it would show. But when the other members of the team had looked at it, they were able to sort of say, well, if you look at the group who are 12 to 14... we do get the results we were looking for there, not in the 10 to 12s. So you can cut the figures, you can reshuffle it, you can make it look to give it the best face that you can hope to get. Can we talk about proof in science? We readily talk about proof, but actually we can't really talk about proof at all. What we can say is that some things are more probable than others. We can say the weight of the evidence goes in this direction. And of course, in science, it's a constantly changing thing. It's an onward march. And the sure results of 10 years ago are now being overthrown, or at least amended and changed and developed as people have built and done further research. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of published studies that have shown one thing that have now seemed to be completely overthrown by better and more recent studies that have been done on a given subject. The abolition of the death penalty was largely driven by the weakness, the lack of confidence people could have in forensic science. He probably did the murder. He probably deserves to hang. But we can't be quite sure. And if any of you have done jury service, my experience of jury service was short and sweet, but we had a straightforward case presented, and the jury, we retired, and the fellow who was chairing the jury said, right, well, look, I think this is hopeless. He never did this. And he made out a compelling case. And the whole group said, yeah, no, he didn't do this. And I thought, well, I think we shouldn't just let it go without a shout here. What if it wasn't like that, and it was like this? And what if that happened, and he was involved? Oh, I see what you mean. So we then had to vote again, and six voted to think the man was guilty, and six voted to think he wasn't guilty. So we thought, right, we've got to talk this through and come to a conclusion of which way it goes. We couldn't. We talked for another hour or more, and eventually we had to take it back to the judge, so we're split 50-50, and we're never going to resolve this one. And they had to have a retrial. So, you know, that's all bringing history and science together of what we can confidently know, and it's quite difficult. Over Christmas, in our family, we played... it's a new game for us. I don't know whether it's new. Sherlock Holmes? Any Sherlock Holmes takers? Well, there's a board game. I'm wondering if a new board game, because I get rather bored of Cluedo and Monopoly and all the rest of it. But the Sherlock Holmes game, we thought, was really rather fun. You're given a story and of Lady So-and-so, who was found murdered in a stable by the stable boy, and so forth. And you have to then work out what happens. You go around the board collecting clues, and you piece together the clues, and until suddenly, out of the confusion, you think, ah, yes, of course, it had to be him because of this motive, with this weapon, and you've got your solution. You still might be wrong, but when it comes together, it's very compelling. There was an interesting program on the radio just recently called Nothing But the Truth. And it looked at this whole business of post-truth and the way truth is relativized and the way it is caught up into frameworks of thinking that people have ideologies. And it made the very interesting point that if you challenge an ideology with facts, you say, well, this, your view of this is completely wrong because of this detail. It actually is likely to backfire on you. Because what the person does is, because he's got a whole world view that puts him in with a view of the truth, he just takes resource from all the other things that he believes, which show perfectly well that this detail can't possibly have happened. So, for instance, climate change, you might say, be challenged about your view about the upper atmosphere and the northern hemisphere. And you dismiss all that because you know perfectly well there is warming of the oceans in the southern hemisphere and all those other things and the polar bears and the ice cap. And so what you do is to reinforce your view. So you actually are more convinced at the end of this discussion than you were at the beginning. And they call that backfiring, challenging a viewpoint with facts, which actually cause the person not to reason about the thing, but to rationalise and to take recourse to the wider picture. Now, this, I think, is what goes on in the Sherlock Holmes thing. You develop a whole picture, and this is what he says you've got to do with somebody who's got an ideology. You've not only got to challenge them with the facts and the details, but you need to then lay out the big picture so they can see, aha, this is what happens with the Sherlock Holmes thing. You've got all these details, and suddenly, I've got it. It all comes together. The radio programme touched on another thing, which I just mentioned in passing, because I think it's quite an important detail. They talked about a phenomenon called truthiness. Now, truthiness is about things that seem as though they're about facts, but actually, it's about values. And the whole of the world of politics is, for instance, caught up in value judgments. This was brought to my attention this week with Tristram Hunt resigning from the Labour Party and accepting the post of director of the Victoria and Albert Museum. And he was asked about his attitude now to the Labour Party, given the problems of the Labour Party. And he said that he would always vote Labour. He always had voted Labour. He always would vote Labour. It hasn't affected. And I think, why is it that people talk like that? Say, I've always been a Conservative. My father was a Conservative. Well, you know, it's got nothing to do with the facts on the ground. It's everything to do with some ideology that's got some truthiness feel to it that they buy into. So to challenge a worldview and to give people a confidence in the truth. Yes, we need facts, we need the data, but we also need to get the big picture. So I'll finish with just an illustration to try and see if this helps. The learned fox comes in, whilst I'm talking here eloquently in a really interesting way, he comes in and says, "Everybody out, quickly as you can, there's an elephant on the roof." And he thought, "Has he flipped? That's not even funny. What's he..." Shut up, Nick, you carry on listening to my fascinating talk. And he insists that there's an elephant on the roof. "Well, you know there isn't an elephant on the roof because there aren't any elephants in Southampton. If there was an elephant in Southampton, he wouldn't be free wandering down the road. And if he was wandering down the road, he wouldn't get up on our roof. It's just physically impossible. So we know that this isn't happening." We then hear an elephant bellowing. And you start giggling, because it's quite obvious that he's got a great joke going here. He's even managed to get a sound of an elephant bellowing. You didn't quite... Well, it didn't seem terribly funny before, but now you hear this noise. What's he on anyway? Is he taking something? And then you see a van pull up outside with Russian circus animal retrieval vehicle written on the side. And then you hear noises on the roof. And the noises get louder. And eventually, a great hole appears in the roof and a huge elephant foot comes through. Now, somewhere along the line, you have been challenged about specific facts and the scales begin to turn and you're becoming increasingly convinced there's something going on here. You may not fully understand it, but ultimately, your whole view of this has got to be re-evaluated. And now you've got to make sense of a foot, the noise, this man suddenly going frenetically mad that we are all in danger, the van outside, and all the rest of it. So whether we can know anything with ultimate certainty is one thing. What we can do is be persuaded. We can look at the balance of evidence which drives us in a position to accept a particular set of circumstances. And if that locks in to a wider framework, another way of looking at the world, a worldview that in itself is coherent, then that's as close as we're going to get to truth. Thank you.